And so our viewpoint is that the private markets will continue to grow. And the basic premise around the private markets growth is that companies, let's focus on private equity for a second, companies are not willing to go public as fast as they did in the past. So today, a median age of an IPO is about 11 to 12 years, right? Compared to 5 or 6, it was 10, 15 years ago. So clearly a massive shift moving upwards. And as companies stay private, they need more capital. So when there is need for more capital, that's the demand side of the equation. You need to then match that up with the supply side.
This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice.
Welcome to the Definitely Uncertain podcast by Gold Rock Capital, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth investors in Israel and around the world. And with me today is Kunal Shah, Managing Director at iCapital Network, the leading global fintech company democratizing the alternative investment universe with about $150 billion or so in client assets. Thank you for joining me, Kunal. Good to see you.
Thank you, David, and good to be with you.
Great. So to kickstart, maybe it'd be worthwhile, Kunal, just for you to introduce yourself. I'll give you the freedom to introduce iCapital as well for those who don't know, who are living under a rock and don't know what iCapital is, and you can take it from there, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, David. So just a quick introduction on iCapital. So we are a fintech platform focusing on powering the world's alternative investments. And so what I mean by that is we are in the middle of a massive inflow coming into the alternative asset class from high net worth capital. All of that capital that is coming in requires a newer solution. The old way of doing paper-based model of subscribing into a fund is not scalable when you go to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of investors around the world. And so we build a technological platform where the onboarding, the subscription, the ongoing reporting, the management of all of that is digitized. Today, we are about $150 billion of AUM. We serve platforms across the world in terms of private banks and wirehouses, independent platforms like RIAs and broker-dealers, family offices, and increasingly, we are also connecting more and more with sort of the international channel. And so part of our discussion around, part of how we met, David, with you, was more around our international expansion. Today, about 25% of our assets are international focused. We have about 1,100 employees, about 400 of them are technologists, so pure technology coders, product managers of the world. And we think that is a very important part of our DNA. Everything we do has to have a technological component around making this asset class and the access to it easier for high net worth investors.
Exciting. And also you're launching a operation in my hometown in Israel, as we speak, I guess, is launching in the near term. So that's exciting as well.
Yes, we are very excited about the Israel market. We have been studying this market for a few years now, and just the amount of wealth that has been created in the market, plus the level of sophistication. My understanding is, and based on what I've seen, is there is a decent amount of understanding of what is alternatives, because there are a lot more risk takers, frankly, in the Israel market around both technology, innovation, venture capital, private equity. So we're really excited about it. We have struck a partnership in the market, and we are looking to expand this partnership all over Israel. And we want to sort of be one of the early movers in this really important market long term. And quickly, just my background, I didn't say that in the earlier part, so I just say my background. So I oversee our research and education effort on private markets. And so my role is to source, identify teams within private markets, conduct due diligence, and then provide educational and product support to our clients who are looking to invest in the in variety of private market products that we are launching on our platform.
That's perfect. Yeah, that's a great background for this conversation. So in terms of Gold Rock and how we think about investing in alternatives, I think the two main reasons why we like the alternative space is, one, we like to outperform the directional liquid markets. So if we invest in private equity, the argument is it's long only, just like buying the stock market, but hopefully you'll have a meaningful outperformance on an annual basis by going illiquid. That's one of the main arguments for us, at least. Second argument is oftentimes in the alternative investment universe, you can find return streams that are differentiated, uncorrelated, less correlated than those directional markets. So you can add some value on an asset basis. Those are the two key reasons. Both of those reasons oftentimes are connected to the fact, potentially, I think at least, are connected to the fact that there's less access to the broader investor world. So because you need to be of a certain wealth or institutional in nature, it limits that investment capital, and therefore buyers and sellers are limited, and therefore there's an inefficiency, if you will, creating an outperformance opportunity. You guys are leading the charge on enabling more retail-oriented, you mentioned the RIA market, the registered investment advisor market in the US, for example, as a channel. That's going to create a lot more capital in the market, differentiated, you know, different types of capital as well. What do you think that will do to creating that outperformance or creating those differentiated investment returns? Is that going to maintain, or is it going to close the gap a little bit with the public markets?
Yeah, look, those are really good sort of questions, David, to start with here. And so our viewpoint is that the private markets will continue to grow. And the basic premise around the private markets growth is that companies, let's focus on private equity for a second, yeah, companies are not willing to go public as fast as they did in the past, right? Mm-hmm. So today, a median age of an IPO is about 11 to 12 years, right? Compared to 5 or 6, it was 10, 15 years ago. So clearly a massive shift moving upwards. And as companies stay private, they need more capital. So when there is need for more capital, that's the demand side of the equation. You need to then match that up with the supply side. And so it's not surprising that there is going to be more demand for capital from GPs, fund managers all over the world, to raise capital. And increasingly, they're looking at different forms of capital, right? Part of the reason is the institutional channel is somewhat saturated. If you're a pension fund, if you're an insurance company, an endowment foundation, you have your allocation and you're not increasing your allocation significantly more. You love the asset class, but you're close to your target. And so as the demand is there from private companies for more capital, private equity knows that they have the deal flow to invest in those companies. They just have to go and find different sources of capital. And high net worth plays a very important role because it's one of the last untapped channels in the world that has been not systematically investing in this asset class. The other piece is just because there's more money coming in, it doesn't mean that you're going to dilute returns automatically. You are going to obviously, as we discussed earlier, there's a significant amount of demand side of the equation where there are just more and more companies looking for that capital. So all this capital that is coming in actually will help fund the gap that is existing right now in the private market space, broadly speaking. But look, there will be some element of return dilution. And so that's why we always preach to our clients, their manager selection is the most critical thing in private markets.
Yeah.
You and I have spoken before, interquartile spread in private markets is massive. It's almost 20 percentage points in the private equity, almost 30 percentage points in venture capital.
Yeah, just to clarify what that means for the audience, essentially what you're saying is I'm not a very good manager versus a very good manager. The difference is very meaningful. You mentioned 20% annualized, which is humongous, as opposed to picking the S&P 500 versus the FTSE 100 or something, you know, in the UK, for example. You're not going to get a dispersion of that nature.
Exactly. Thank you for clarifying that. Exactly. So when I refer to interquartile spread, I talk about the 75th percentile, so top 25 versus the bottom 25. And that's the 20 percentage points. Compare that to public markets, I think that's about 500 basis points, right? So you're getting 4 times as much outperformance or dispersion between sort of different segments of private markets. And that's exactly what we got to focus on. And we got to teach our clients, we our partners and say, when you invest in private markets, make sure you have a professional approach, a more disciplined approach on who you're investing in.
Yeah.
And David, to be honest, today's market is perfect to make this point. What I've seen in the last 5 to 7 years up until this year, the industry will just continue to grow and the dispersion didn't really matter. And now we are seeing that there are a lot of things that were done in the markets, broadly speaking, that were not sound or disciplined. New entrants came in and they took share, but they didn't really have a very well-established process in place. And so in our view, in today's environment, the dispersion is going to widen. And the reason it's going to widen is because there were a lot of new players who entered the market in the last 10 years. They had the right idea, but they didn't have the infrastructures, the skill set, and oftentimes the historical expertise to manage a private fund. Private fund takes a long time. It's a 10-year fund oftentimes.
Yes.
And so having that expertise is something that didn't have, was not in every manager's capabilities, but yet they were able to raise money because people followed the story around private market is going to continue to grow. On the flip side, we are seeing today some of those same managers could struggle because they didn't really have the right infrastructure in place to manage risk. And so we think the good ones will continue to get better in this environment, taking larger share in the coming years from the new entrants.
So how does iCapital then, if I may get specific on iCapital just for a second, because that's an important point you just made with the dispersion and the increased number of managers that are going to be out there trying to raise that capital. How is iCapital going to, what's the service you're providing them to the end investor? Because obviously you're going to a less sophisticated investor class. You're going to an investor class where they're not going to have the time to spend on searching for the best managers out there. You're going to be that pipe for them. You're going to be that access point for them. So what are you guys doing in order to sift through the dispersion mess of private equity as an example?
Yeah. So one of the things that we talk about all the time internally is education.
Yes.
Education is one of the most important things that we got to do for our clients around the world. And that means that we have to translate that in local languages in many cases. When we go to Israel, when you go to other parts of the world, we got to translate our educational content to make sure that it fits the local language, local cultures, but also local regulation, right? And so huge initiative within the firm. And what we do that is we try to break it down. Like we have an educational course called a program called Alts Edge, where it's a chapter by chapter program where you spend 50 to 60 minutes learning about what is private equity, how do you invest in private equity? Similarly, what is hedge funds? What is private credit? What is real assets? All that sort of major asset classes that we need to cover. And the goal there is to explain how to invest in those asset classes, what those asset classes provide from a risk-return spectrum, and then how do you conduct diligence?
Yeah.
So that's a critical service. The other piece I would say is due diligence. We provide due diligence for any product that we launch on our platform where we are distributing the product. We are providing due diligence. But increasingly, we're also providing due diligence to a variety of products that are not being distributed through our platform, but are using our platform to come to advisors. So there are a lot of fund managers out there who are, you know, able to access your capital or come to you leveraging iCapital platform today. We are trying to provide some level of due diligence support to most of those managers because our sort of platform is built for that level of support to all of our clients. And so we are committed to providing the right tools and resources to our investor base so they understand what they're buying into. Obviously, we cannot control every single behavior because that's right. Not something we do, but we think that if we get our audience more smart about the alternatives and help them understand the risk they're taking, the long term will take care of itself.
Interesting. Yeah. And just to go back to a point you made earlier, which I think is really important for listeners to understand better, you mentioned the fact that companies are taking a lot longer staying private until they decide to become a publicly traded company. And they end up being much more meaningfully in terms of size, much more significant in terms of size prior to an IPO as opposed to a number of years ago, which means that if an investor wants to gain access to the broader economic growth or the broader economic activity, not exposing yourself to private equity actually is, you're having a shrinking effect on your exposure to the broader economy by just investing in the public markets. So one of the things that always capture my attention when it comes to the outperformance of public markets versus, private markets versus public markets, that private markets are often, the sector dynamics are very different. In other words, most private market investors focus in on areas where there's faster growth, more exciting sectors, less boring sectors, et cetera, as opposed to the public markets where you have a lot of elements there, like the financials or retail or energy or things of that nature, where a lot of the private markets avoid. So how do you guys think about that, if at all, in terms of sector diversification for an investor when they're thinking about allocating a part of their wealth to private markets?
Look, in many ways, what you're referring to is law of large numbers, right? Once you get larger, growth is not as easy to get, right? Doubling your revenue every year, or every 2 years, or every 3 years is easier when you're a small company. Once you get a big company, it slows down significantly. And that's just natural. And that's the beauty of private markets. Most of the companies that you see in private markets, especially in private equity, right, are smaller companies. Even the large cap funds of private equity, when they're investing in companies, they're equivalent to Russell 3000 companies. Their market caps oftentimes are $10 billion or less. So they are not big companies by any measure.
Yeah.
And they provide significant opportunities around growth. But one of the things that we really like about private equity, especially, is their ability to control the outcome. And so I say this all the time, that public markets live quarter to quarter.
Yes.
So not only there's not enough growth, but you got to manage your companies based on the earnings. And that does not give you much flexibility to maneuver around long-term projects. If you go to your shareholders today and say, I think the business plan is changing, I got to build a company for the next 5 years, that means the earnings have to be sacrificed in the near term. The reality is most likely the investors will essentially say, that's not in our interest. And they essentially will send your stock price down. Whereas private markets are exactly the opposite. They're like, we can take the time to build a company if we believe the long-term outcome is really the most important thing to focus on. And so there's a better alignment of interest between management teams and shareholders around creating long-term value. That is unique to the asset class. Plus, you control the company, right? In public markets, you don't control the company. You're right. A tiny investor in that company. You can make some noise, but reality is that you don't really have a direct say. In private equity, you own the company. And when you own the company, you have more data points, you're meeting with the management teams more frequently. You essentially are making decisions with far more data at your fingertips. And that is a very powerful lever to pull, which is why we think private equity has always outperformed, because they just have much more skilled management team with more data at their on their hand to make those decisions. So that's the way we think about that. The other piece is, and I'll pause after this, which is private markets also tends to have opportunity to consolidate and acquire many smaller companies. And there is a lot of fragmentation. There are so many sub verticals within each of the major sectors, within healthcare or within technology, within consumer. There's so many companies because private markets tends to have millions of companies. So if you acquire a really strong platform company, where you believe in the management team in the sector, you have hundreds, if not thousands, of potential acquisition opportunities within that sector. And that is very powerful, because then you can go to work and say, I can essentially roll up and create a much better platform long-term for the next buyer to have, or potentially take the company public. So just more tools at your disposal, given the size, but also the way you run your companies.
That's really interesting. Take what you're saying a bit looking toward the future as well, because one of the additional advantages, I guess you could say, in particular on private equity versus public equity, is that if you are exposed to public equity, you put your money in and you're basically buying a series of companies at a very specific valuation as determined by the free market. In a private equity fund, there's a buyer and they determine that price at the purchase time, and that's it. So when you deploy that money, when you're getting a capital call, when you're being called by that private equity fund to then invest in a target company, that's it. That's the point in time in which you're investing. So thinking about today, public markets are down 25%. Private markets are down meaningfully less for various reasons. We can talk about if you want. But if you get a capital call from a private equity fund today, they're buying a company at a determined price that's a bilateral, essentially, between them and the company. When you're buying the equity markets today, if you say, ooh, the market's down 25%, let me go pour some money into the equity markets because it's down so much, you're putting a lot of money to work at a determined valuation that you're not negotiating so much. So when you think about moving forward, 2023, 2024, I don't know where the economy is going. Is it going to be a recession? But one thing seems to be somewhat clear. Rates are probably going to be higher than we're used to, at least for the previous decade. And that creates a cost of capital issue on public and private markets in the same vein. So when you think about that outperformance and you think about that timing of the deployment of capital, what are you thinking about in terms of areas that you're going to focus on or advise clients to invest in or to generate that outperformance to make sure that the money trickles in over a certain period of time in the right places at the right time in this new kind of world that we're living in with higher rates.
Yeah. So a lot of interesting points in there. So let me start with by one sort of basic observations and basic rule that we all follow in private markets.
Yeah.
Valuations in private markets are on a 6 to 9 month lag. So what in public markets oftentimes gets reflected in private markets later. And so I think we're in the early stages of a reset happening in private markets from a valuation perspective. So public markets had a massive fall off in terms of valuation. We are seeing some of the changes in the valuation in private markets happening as we speak right now. And I think that will play out over the next 6 months or so before we get to an equilibrium. Right now, valuations are a bit higher in private markets than public markets, but long-term, private market valuations have been lower. If you look at the last 10 years average, private markets have been lower than public markets from an entry point for a similar size company, a similar style of company. So that's point one. The second point I think it's important to note is, to our earlier point, there's faster growth. So private markets may not capture all of the downturn in the public markets because private market companies tend to have much better growth. So we are seeing that companies are still more resilient, more stable. The fundamentals have not changed. Yeah, the future probably might be softer, right? So if you're growing at 30%, maybe you're growing at 20%. But guess what? 20% is still a pretty good growth rate in today's environment. So we are seeing that hold to a degree that supports the valuation that we are seeing out there right now. So those are the sort of the very important points to make here from a valuation adjustment perspective. Look, 2023 and 2024, in our view, are going to be very good years because as this valuation reset happens, you're going to be able to buy into companies at a much attractive. That's always happened. If you look at last two recessions, excluding 2020 because that was the shortest recession, 2 month recession, but a 3 month recession. But if you look at global financial crisis, if you look at dot-com crisis, in both of those cases, private equity outperformed the years before recession. So during the recession years, private equity delivered better returns than the years prior. So if you like private equity going into 2023, you should like private equity even more in 2023 and potentially 2024 as well, because they have shown really strong returns over a long period of time. And so all those things that we've discussed, faster growth, more tools at your disposal to create value, consolidated industries, you know, active management, all of that will play out. And we have no reason to believe that any of that has changed, even though the valuation environment might be different.
Yeah.
The cost of borrowing is going to be high. The last thing I would say is cost of borrowing is going to be high. And so private equity will probably have to focus on less leverage in those transactions going forward and use more operating earnings as a way to create value.
Yeah, that was going to be my next point about leverage. I want to ask it your point on that. So public and private, again, same kind of a perspective, comparing public versus private markets. Public companies are also levered typically. So it's not just the private markets. Obviously, private markets perhaps maybe more, but it's not only the leverage on the company level, but also what we've noticed over the years, over the past number of years, is that due to low interest rates, funds have been able to create some form of leverage themselves on a fund level, not only on a deal level, through capital call facilities or the like. Are you seeing dudes change in terms of how to use leverage and how to generate returns, outperformance returns in the private markets? Are they going to be just focused a lot on the valuation much more and less leverage, less capital call facilities, less financial engineering and much more growth focus? Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah. So look, I would say a couple of things. One is the industry has done a better job since global financial crisis to reduce leverage at the company level.
Yeah.
So what I look focus is LTV, right? And so LTV ratios, loan to value ratios,
right,
during global financial crisis or years before that, oftentimes are 65, 70%. So those were highly levered deals, leaving very small room for error, essentially. That has changed. The LTVs today are 50%, in some cases lower. And I think when the rates will go up, LTV might be closer to 45%. So they will continue to come down a bit because the you don't want to pay a significant amount of interest rate. But the other piece is this companies probably should be able to absorb leverage better because they are faster growing companies. And oftentimes in sectors where there's high free cash flow, right? Technology, software, let's take software, for example. I know software has seen a significant decline in public markets. By the way, a lot of that is sentimental, right? people essentially loved technology coming into 2022. All of a sudden, the growth is not as strong as they thought, and they sent everything down. But is it supposed to be down 50, 60, 70%? Probably not, but that's what we're dealing with, and people will rebound as well. So public markets oftentimes have a bit of a sentimental approach to the way they do things. Private markets are focused on more fundamentals. So you take leverage if the company has high cash flow generation ability, that it can support that as well. And so LTV has come down, but they also invested in sectors that have a good amount of cash flows to support that. But then the other piece is we should focus on how they are able to pay down leverage through growth. So if the companies are growing, that LTV will continue to come down because the company's overall enterprise value will continue to grow, right? In other words, if you grow every year by 10 to 20% and your rate leverage stays flat, then you technically you're paying down your leverage from an LTV perspective because arguably your value goes up as your company grows in value as well.
On a multiple of your profit, so to speak. If you look at the valuation of a company on a multiple of profit or multiple of EBITDA, for example, then naturally your loan value goes down.
Exactly. And that's what you're underwriting for, right? That's what we are underwriting. When we look at managers, we are emphasizing how are you growing your companies? And make sure that the growth is sustainable. In other words, making sure that it's organic and inorganic through acquisitions. And it's not just one time COVID boost you got and then everything falls apart, right? A lot of companies who got COVID boost in the last few years, but then they have come down to earth in the last 6 months or so. So focusing on companies that are more sustainable, more sort of reliable pattern of growth. To your point around the leverage facilities, look, that is becoming common in the industry. Yeah. I have become common in the last 5 to 8 years. I don't see it changing. I still see managers using the same leverage facilities. But I think what you may see is they may not have it outstanding for as long of a period of time.
Yeah.
So right now, many of those firms have sometimes 1 to 2 years of leverage facility outstanding. So they can potentially continue to incur cost as the cost of borrowing goes up. You probably cannot keep it outstanding for that long of a period because the cost is higher to your end investors. But we are not seeing a major shift happening right now from GP's perspective around use of credit facility. Like it or not, that's here to stay. There are some investors who don't like it. There are some investors who are okay with that. But that's just the way industry has structured itself right now.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't mind it as long as it's limited. But yeah, we see it with everybody more or less today.
Yeah.
One of the things that we did a lot of investing in over the years is smaller funds, lower middle market funds. Maybe you could talk for a bit about just your perspective on alpha in the private markets, large versus small funds, the big boys versus the smaller boys. A lot of times there's advantages to being very large. You have access to financing, which is better. You have scale on the underlying companies. Perhaps the growth is less. Perhaps, or maybe the smaller companies. So one of the reasons why we decided to go small a number of times was more valuation driven, which may change now moving forward. What are you seeing, if anything, in terms of large managers versus the smaller managers and the advantages thereof?
Yeah, a few things I would say. One is, first of all, we always believe in diversified portfolio. So we think that any well-diversified portfolio should have exposure to small, mid, and large companies. And that's the way we think about the world. That's what we have offered to our clients. We have offered a lot of middle market buyout funds and growth equity funds. And we also have offered large market buyout and growth equity funds. If you look at the data in last 10 years, what we have seen is the large market have rebounded very well. And we wrote a paper about this, which I'm happy to share with you and your audience here, which about large market buyout, where large market buyout ended up being one of the better performing segments of buyout in the last 10 years. Actually, one of the best performing segments of the last 10 years. So clearly, there have been some changes that has happened, and partly because they have changed the way they approach, right? Going into global financial crisis, the large market buyout managers were doing a lot of sharing of deals. There were a lot of coalition, for lack of a better word, where there were consortium of deals where 4 or 5 or 6 fund managers would join forces to buy a company. There were a lot of leverage, as we discussed earlier, on those deals. And when things got difficult, there was no one driver of that deal because there were 4 or 5 or 6 potentially. And in one case, I remember a very well-known deal, there were 9 sort of buyout firms at the table, right? So that's a difficult place to be.
Yeah.
So we are not seeing that right now. And the second thing, we have seen less leverage, as we discussed. Third thing we have seen is the deal size has not gone up. Very rarely today, deal size is eclipsing $30, $40 billion. Most of the deals are still below that. Whereas if you remember 07 and 08, there were every month you would see another deal come out, which was bigger than the prior deal. And there was like a bit of a sort of land grab of making sure that you have the biggest deal announced in the world.
Right.
A lot of that has changed in the industry, which is good for the industry. So we think that large market buyout has really turned itself around in the last 15 years to demonstrate their value in the portfolio. That doesn't mean that it's not risk-free, right? There's a lot of risk there. There's less amount of companies to buy. Middle market has more companies to buy. There is fewer exit paths. You're looking at selling it to another large market buyout manager or IPO, which IPO is short right now, so it affects your fund exit options compared to middle market. But middle market has, because there are 10 times as many middle market buyout firms than the large market buyout firms.
Right.
So every deal is more competitive. And we have seen that valuations in the middle market have gone up recently compared to large market. So I think there are pros and cons, as I'm saying, of both, right? And so you got to make sure that you build a very balanced and diverse portfolio. And it all goes back to manager selection. We started this conversation, David, by talking about manager selection. If you work with the right manager, no matter what the sector is, you are going to be fine, because in private equity, past success oftentimes is a really good indicator of future success. Because I think you have seen this data, but persistence of returns in private markets is far more consistent. There's a reason why top quartile managers, the dispersion of what we discussed earlier, is as high, because the good managers continue to figure out a way to stay in the top half of the industry. And if you can find a way to get allocation of one of those managers, you will be able to build really good value and put, you know, add put value to your clients' portfolios.
That's really interesting. Can I just take a minute just to talk about credit? Because I know you guys probably also do stuff in the credit space as well. It's an area that's gotten enormous popularity when rates were zero, essentially, for the past decade, and people wanted to get some level of income streams, especially the institutional investors. Just curious, we never really spent a lot of time in that space, to be honest. We more did special sits in distress, but not much in the performing direct lending market. But just in terms of the amount of the quantum of capital has been enormous. Is that going to continue? Is the more sale-oriented market that you deal with, or the more institutional market, is that going to continue its pace? Or do you think because rates have increased and the ability to buy a fixed income portfolio that's completely liquid at making 5-6% a year now, is that market going to now shrink? What's your view on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something that we are looking at ourselves right now, right?
Yeah.
There are a couple of points I'll make. The one thing that we like about private credit a lot is this floating rate nature, right? So they are floating rate, they get reset every few months, and that helps you sort of increase your coupon payment back to your investors. Yeah. And so that is the most important data point to essentially observe, is the spread between the risk-free rate and your rate. And as long as you're going to continue getting 500 or 600 basis points of spread over risk-free rate, I think you are providing really good value to your clients. And I think they will do that. Although I believe there is some limits to that, right? Companies are not going to continue paying infinitely from you, right? So at some point, there will be some cap, and that's what we need to observe in that space. But there's no doubt today clients have more options. People who are looking for steady income, they have more options today than they. So there is more competition for that. And I think there might be some decline in fundraising as a result of that for private credit managers, or the interest may not be as much. And I totally get that, but they still provide value in our opinion, because it's the spread you care about. And by the way, if you're getting 5-6% in traditional fixed income, it's still below inflation, right? So on a real basis, you're still losing money. So private credit actually helps you get better return versus inflation, because you're still beating the inflationary target and getting additional return as a result of that. So we think it has a role in portfolio, but it's not as simple as it was 5 years ago. I acknowledge that. The other piece that I think is more interesting to us to observe is, will we have higher defaults, right?
Yes.
So as the market is where it is right now, recessionary-like, may be in recession soon, that oftentimes leads to higher defaults. And will we see a pickup in private equity-backed companies defaulting, whether it's middle market, large market? We don't know yet. We are not seeing that yet, but you cannot discount that. And when you have defaults picking up, that affects your portfolio negatively, that affects your return stream negatively, and how do managers respond to that? That's a big outstanding question we have right now. We are paying close attention to that. We are not seeing anything right now that is concerning, But I want to continue observing that because I think we still have many months remaining in this dislocation right now. And we do not want to completely sort of eye off the ball there until we feel that we are outside of this sort of really choppy environment that we're living in.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be something to look out for, is the private credit market defaults, because they've basically, obviously not 100%, it's not been a zero default rate, but pretty close to zero defaults for the past 10 years. They underwrite to a certain zero loss ratio and promise their investors a certain return on a zero delinquency number. And they basically hit that bogey pretty much each time, which is quite amazing. And it's going to be interesting to see. I think partly, this is a bit parenthetical, but I think partly it relates, ironically, to the fact that they have the covenants, the legal power they have as a creditor has also weakened over the years. And it basically allowed for the private equity managers just to make sure they're paying their interest payments and get a refi eventually. And as long as that path was managed well, they could keep all their portfolio at par. Interest payments are getting paid. Refi is going to happen. So that may change. It would be very interesting to see. One thing that you mentioned in passing, and I wanted to maybe leave this point as well with the audience, you mentioned in passing, I wanted you to maybe touch on it a bit more, relates to time horizon. We're dealing, our client base are what they call the significant or the super high net worth investors, which their time horizon is quite long naturally. So that's why we're active in the private markets. In the RIA market, where you guys are active in democratizing the universe of alternatives and of basically providing an access for people who typically never had such access, now they're gaining that access, they may have a mindset of working with their investment advisor for 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year, maybe time horizon in terms of how they think about investing. When they're stepping into this private market environment, how are you educating? How are they thinking about that time horizon change? Because that really is important. As you mentioned, these funds are typically in an area of 10 years. And I think the data actually shows better about the data, but I think the data actually shows more like 13 years as the average length in reality, meaning they're 10-year funds, but the reality oftentimes is a bit longer. So walk us through, as advice to a high net worth sort of thinking about investing in private equity, how should they think about their investment horizon?
Yeah, look, that's a great question as well. And so the way I always think about this and iCapital thinks about this is we need to provide different solutions for different markets. And so what we have seen in the market in the last 5 to 7 years is this growth in what we call accredited investor-friendly products, right? Where you essentially are bringing down access to clients who historically have not been able to access this market. And that's a trend, and that's a trend that is going to continue for a long time. And for clients who are new to the asset class, or clients who do not have the net worth to qualify, should go into those strategies where you get some level of liquidity, which is provided by the fund every quarter. And so people who are new to this, they should probably get their feet wet with investing in things that they probably don't understand fully, but they have the liquidity. So if they have some second thoughts, they can get out. But what we have seen is once you get in, you really like it because it still is less volatile. So if you look at a traditional 60-40 portfolio and you add 60-40 with this accredited options, your portfolio volatility goes down. And I'm happy to share some presentations, some data around that with you as well. So that's one piece. And then the second piece that we discuss is education. Again, nothing should be done with any client without providing them the right support and tools to understand what they're buying. Yeah. And so we spend a lot of time, we'll continue to spend a lot of time making sure clients understand what you're buying and what should be your horizon, what should your expectation be, so there is no confusion about this 5 years down the line. So understanding who your client is, understanding their journey away from 60-40 is a critical first step. And then you provide them the right resources to fully understand what they're buying into.
That's super helpful. No, this has been great. And it's exciting to watch you guys really take the world by storm and provide access to these really interesting differentiated investment opportunities, which used to be only exclusive to a very short list of investors and now is getting broader and broader with your help. And I really think you guys are doing a great job. And it's been great chatting with you, Kunal. I really appreciate your time. And thanks everybody for listening as well to this episode. And we hope to see you next time.
Thank you, David. Good to be with you. Awesome.
Take care.